It's a simple question of weight ratio.
How do I look so young? Quite simple. A complete vegetable diet, 12 hours sleep a night, and lots of makeup.
First, the award for the alumnus who's gained the most weight, Homer Simpson.
Oh, my God!
How'd you do it, Homer?
I discovered a meal between breakfast and brunch.
Why don't you go on a diet?
Because I like to eat. Is that such a crime?
Well, as far as I'm concerned, it ain't over until the slightly overweight but still working on it lady sings.
I mean, it's hard to get fat on a vegan diet.
I'm not fat. It's all this fur. It makes me look poofy.
All right. You have fat hair, but when you're ready to talk, I'm here.
What was it we had for dinner tonight?
Well, we had a choice, steak or fish.
Yes, I remember I had lasagna.
Shut up. The camera adds 10 pounds.
So how many cameras are actually on you?
I know what that feels like. 312-580-CFRA. I'm Rob Snow. Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. It's time for the Wednesday house call. Every single phone line is available right now. Now, you hear that Dr. Dworkin has a bit of a cough.
Yeah.
So I recommend the Benylin formula. I had to pull that out, but hopefully we'll get you through the hour. Mark was a little bit under the weather this morning, too.
Pretty hoarse voice this morning.
I don't know what's going on with you guys. Now.
Yeah.
Big story this week locally in health news is cleanliness in the hospitals and whether that is resulting in an increase in C. diff in local hospitals. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think what's important is that you have to understand how this bacterium functions.
Okay.
Right? There are two forms of existence that it has. Okay. One is a spore form, and the spore form essentially is resistant to acid, various cleaners.
It's resistant,
yeah, and antibiotics. You can't kill the spores. They will fly through the air and land on different surfaces. So you can understand that if you have all these spores around, you really have to use some industrial strength cleaners to get rid of those spores, because if you were to touch a tabletop, Rob, with those spores, they'd be on your hands. You bring your hands to your...
Sure. Next thing you know, touching doorknobs and everything else.
That's
right.
Yeah. And you become a carrier for those spores. You may not necessarily get sick, but you can pass that on to somebody else.
Yeah.
The vegetative state is when that spore is ingested, it converts into the propagating bacteria. And that's
when... Once it's in your body.
Once it's in your body, and that's where antibiotics can kill it. The problem, though, is that you have to account for human behavior. You have a lot of people who come into the hospital every day. You have surfaces that even after you clean them, you have to remember that bacteria, their goal is to survive and reproduce. So even after you clean a tabletop, even after you wash your hands, the normal bacteria that are on your hands reproduce and cover your skin again within a matter of a few minutes to an hour. So that's the biology part of it. So you do the best you can to try to isolate people who are sick. The risk factors for C. difficile infections is your age, antibiotic use, and also using medications that suppress acid in your stomach for a long time. That'll also contribute to it.
Such as?
PPIs, so things like pantoprazole or any of those ones that are by prescription that are out there. And they suppress acids. You take it for reflux disease or ulcers and things. So if age is a primary risk factor, a lot of older people in hospital.
Oh, for sure.
And a lot of people sitting in hospital with nowhere to go.
Yes.
So that's a risk factor that you can't control for. No matter how much you clean, no matter how much you try to stop the advance of bacterial infection, you are going to have people that are on antibiotics for infections. Older people come in for pneumonias, bladder infections, kidney infections, all kinds of stuff. So they have these antibiotics. They're older. That's two out of the three major risk factors for C. difficile.
Right. So they're already susceptible.
So they're already susceptible. Yeah. You have populations that could be carriers of the infection coming into hospital. So the hospital could be completely devoid, spotless.
Spotless,
right?
Yeah.
You open the doors and people come in. So you can't blame the hospital per se and say, this is the hospital's fault.
Right.
You can only clean as much as you can, but you cannot control for the tens of thousands of interactions that happen on a daily basis on every ward from all people that come in. and say that somehow they're not doing their job. I don't have seen no evidence in the hospital where I met the general doing my stuff. I've seen no evidence of cleaning.
So what will we do to make it more manageable then? Use hand sanitizers when you come in, those kinds of things?
You have to ensure that when people come into the, it's little things, right?
Yes.
So people come into hospital. If you were to stand and watch those alcohol dispensers and people come into the hospital, more than half don't use them. Or they'll go and they won't even stop walking. They just walk by, they press the button, they get a little bit on their hands, they rub their hands for 5 seconds and that's it. You gotta use alcohol, that alcohol stuff on your hands for 30 seconds at least. And okay. all over your hands.
You kind of got to use it liberally,
yeah,
so
you
to
have
speak.
To use it liberally, yeah. And your hands have to be wet with the alcohol, and you have to do that for at least 30 seconds.
Okay.
But again, if you have 90% of people do that and 10% don't, those 10% are touching the elevator buttons and everything. So after, just as I mentioned, after you clean your hands, you can get that bacteria back on your hands in a few minutes. So you can see that in order to help the hospital, everybody has to cooperate.
Right.
And I don't know if you're going to achieve that.
It may not even be achievable, yeah. Right?
So you try to do the best you can. You identify the risk factors. You clean what you can clean. You educate the cleaning staff to understand how this works. And that's an ongoing process, and they are doing that.
Yeah.
But you're still going to get people who get infected because you're still giving them antibiotics, and they're still older people.
And you said that once somebody contracts a C. diff infection, mm-hmm. what do you do then? How do you manage that person? What's the?
There are antibiotics that are given. It also causes severe diarrhea, so you have to make sure they don't get dehydrated.
Right.
Then you also have, compounding that, their other underlying condition that they originally were admitted to hospital.
Sure.
So you're dealing with that
chronic
as well.
Chronic conditions, yeah.
Yeah. So they could still have a pneumonia. So not only that, you give them the antibiotic for pneumonia, now you have to give them an antibiotic to treat the C. difficile. Infectious disease usually comes by, the consultants come by to give recommendations on the particular treatment for each patient, depends on their, again, underlying condition, because there are different antibiotics that can be used. So you treat it with antibiotics, but those antibiotics not only are killing off the C. difficile, but they also play havoc with whatever is left in your intestine with regards to the bacteria that are healthful for you. So you can see that it's not an easy process. Now, that being said, and without trying to gross people out, there is a treatment that is looking to be much more favorable, and they are doing it in certain institutions, not here yet. And that's where they're
in other countries.
In Canada and also in the United States, because again, C. difficile happens when you are destroying the normal bacteria that protect your intestine. Right? They are there. They do not give the C. difficile the opportunity to grow because there's too many of them. They literally swamp it. So when you give the antibiotic, you are destroying those bacteria, and as a result, the C. difficile takes over. So the idea is to give that person back those bacteria that they are missing, and it has been shown to be quite successful. And in many cases, you do not have to use the antibiotic to kill the C. difficile because these bacteria do the job for you. And it literally is a transplant of those bacteria, usually through, they do colonoscopy, they check the colon first and they use a tube and they put the bacteria back in. I know it sounds gross, but it works. And it also helps reduce your risk of bacterial resistance. So those are some of the options that are being looked at with regards to getting that kind of treatment available, especially for older folks where the antibiotics that are used are quite powerful and can cause other side effects for them as well.
To the phones, and let's go to Martin in Ottawa. Martin.
Hello, doctor.
Hi.
Just a quick question. I'm going through a bout of kidney stones and having some difficulties with that. Just wanted to ask if having kidney problems, does it affect reproductive system, me being a male trying to have a baby? Does it affect kidney problems, do they affect anything?
Well, the kidney stone will not cause any difficulty with regards to fertility or sperm counts. Where it will cause some discomfort is as the stone is being passed, it has to go through the urethra and can damage the urethra, and you can get some bleeding. So when you urinate, you can notice some blood, but then that heals up. But the pathways that are responsible for producing sperm and maintaining fertility are not affected by the stone. It's a separate pathway. The only common pathway is when it finally joins up at the level of the prostate gland. The tubes are called the vas deferens, and they come from the testicles and they run up to the prostate gland. And from there, it empties into the penile urethra and then comes out. So even if you had a stone that passed through the urethra, it wouldn't cause any harm to the sperm cells that were passing through. So the answer is that the kidney stones are not going to affect fertility or the ability to conceive a child.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome, Martin.
Okay, Martin, we're going to stop here. It's 3:22 on News Talk Radio, 580 CFRA. We will reset right after the news at 3:30. Dr. Barry can get something for his cough.
Why does that pharmacist have to be 2.5 feet higher than everybody else? Who the hell is this guy? Clear out, everybody. I'm working with pills up here. I'm taking them from this big bottle, and then I'm going to put them in a little bottle. That's my whole job. I can't be down on the floor with you people. Yes, I'd like to get this prescription filled, please. All right, but you wait down there. No one comes up here but me.
Dr. Barry Dworkin is here. Wednesday house call on 580 CFRA. Jean.
Yes,
hi,
Rob.
Hi, Jean.
How are you today?
We're good. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you.
What's
Quick
the matter?
Question for Dr. Dworkin.
Sure.
My sister-in-law has severe kidney disease,
mm-hmm.
recently diagnosed. She'd been in the hospital twice. She was just released. This time round, they did a biopsy, but she hasn't got the results yet.
Mm-hmm.
They've started her on biweekly injections, they said, for a month. We're not sure. My husband and I are quite concerned. It's my husband's only sister.
Right.
We're not sure what the injections are for, because this isn't a whole hospital and we're over on this side.
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, if you think our hospitals are in bad shape,
right,
theirs are not the best either. But anyhow, we are quite concerned. And like I say, we're not sure what this injection is supposed to do.
Okay, so what do you think these injections be for?
I have no idea what the injections are. I would really have to know what medication they were providing, and also what kind of kidney disease, because it's...
They said her kidneys are only functioning at between 5 and 11%.
Right, so she's at the point where she would likely need to have dialysis.
She has refused dialysis.
Well, that's not very good.
No, we're quite sure about that ourselves. We tried to encourage her, but...
Yeah, usually anything below 15, and it's actually what we call it's called an EGFR, or a calculated glomerular filtration rate, which simply means... how effective the kidneys are at filtering things. And normally kidneys have filtration rates, usually for healthy people, above 60. And when you reach down to less than 15, that's dialysis territory, because there really isn't very much in terms of medications that are going to help that. The injections are probably something to allow things to pass through the kidney to try to affect kidney function in some way, given her refusal for dialysis. But the problem is that it is not going to be able to replace dialysis. If it did, everybody would be doing that. But unfortunately, if she continues to refuse dialysis, she's not, to be blunt, she's not going to be around here for much longer.
No, well, we both suspect that. She just turned 66, and it's a sad situation.
Yeah, she's still young,
Very young.
Dialysis in this case would certainly prolong her life quite a bit. Was the kidney damage from diabetes or blood pressure? It was diabetes.
Diabetes.
Yeah.
Her levels are up and down with the sugar levels. She's injecting insulin twice a day.
Right.
And then once every 2 weeks with this kidney, whatever it is.
Yeah. But it's unfortunate that she's refusing the dialysis, because, again, with kidneys that don't work that well, she's going to end up in the hospital again.
Yes,
she'll...
Well, Jean, if you find out anything more, just give us a call back, okay?
I
and,
will.
Of course, Dr. Dworkin is here on Sunday as well. So,
okay. Thank you very much.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye. That's hard, eh?
It's very difficult. I mean, it's a big commitment to do dialysis, but when you're at
that
point...
It's so invasive, though, right?
You're sitting there for, three times a week for about 8 hours, having a machine clean, detoxify your blood for you, and you know, it is a significant impact on your quality of life. But at the same time, when your kidneys aren't functioning well,
your quality of life is very poor
to begin with, because you don't feel well, because you have this buildup over time. She's going to end up back at the hospital because she's going to have the metabolites that normally would be cleared by the kidneys from normal body processes build up to levels that the body can't handle.
So what do you do? And I'll get to the other call shortly, but
sure.
You have a woman who is obviously, she's got some kind of late stage kidney disease, mm-hmm. right? Is that someone who would be, you would need a transplant eventually, or well, what would you do there?
That's why I asked if what was the cause. She has diabetes.
Yeah, diabetes, yeah.
And so if her diabetes is not very well controlled, that doesn't make you the ideal candidate for a transplant. Also, because her kidney function is poor, it belies the fact that she likely has other vascular disease. She likely has heart disease, peripheral vascular disease. Anywhere the arteries go, the kidneys are not functioning in isolation or being affected in isolation. It's going to be everywhere. So when you talk about a transplant, you're talking about a lot of things that have to happen, right? You have to have immunosuppressive medications. You have to ensure that that person's cardiovascular system can deal with that transplant. The surgery can take a long time, especially transplanting a kidney. That is a huge surgery because they literally have to cut through your body to get to where the kidneys are. And so it can be quite traumatic. Diabetics don't heal very well. They're more prone to infections. So it becomes a very complex thing. Kidney transplants are usually recommended for people that have much less chronic disease. So for example, if they had a autoimmune condition that damaged their kidneys, right? But only the kidneys were affected and the rest of their body was okay, they would be a better candidate. But for somebody that has generalized disease, that makes it much more problematic.
Okay. Let's go to Mike in Ottawa. Mike, go ahead, sir.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Dr. Dworkin, after listening to that that situation, this isn't really that serious, but I do have a 13-year-old daughter
mm-hmm.
who's very active in sports and completely healthy up until, that's why I'm asking you if there's a problem.
Sure.
The thing is, we noticed, and she noticed, she brought it to our attention, her rib cage, the upper rib closest to the, the top.
Yeah.
There is a quite significant protrusion.
Mm-hmm.
And when we touch it and feel it, it feels like it's just part of her rib cage.
Right.
Now, okay, we've got two doctors here, and they're both shaking their head. Well, yes, we know what this is.
We had somebody else in the office today. She's 19 or 20. It had very similar, big bump on the rib cage.
Right. Okay.
It stuck out. Very athletic, also very active.
Okay. So it's very, what do you think about that then?
Well, I mean, does it cause her pain? Is it
not at all?
No. If when you're touching it, it feels literally like a rib. You can follow it along, and it follows the rib cage. That in itself is nothing that would really raise any concern if someone were to come into the office with that, because you do have variances in growth. The other thing to keep in mind is that area, if it's right next to the breastbone, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, where it joins up. That area is also cartilage, because we think of our ribs as being solid bone that run from front to back. But really, as your rib approaches sort of, if you think of, if you draw an imaginary line down the front of your chest across the nipple, sort of towards the center, as you move towards the center, that bone turns into cartilage and it forms a joint in that line. So when you're breathing, your ribs actually will bend a bit because it joins up with that cartilage. So that cartilage runs from the rib at around that level all the way to the sternum. And sometimes when you're very active, the cartilage gets pulled on. It can get a bit inflamed. It can get a bit larger, but it's not indicative of any disease process per se. It's not. It's certainly not indicative of any mass or tumor, especially if, when you're looking at this, the size isn't changing. It's relatively static. It doesn't hurt. It's something to watch, but really in terms of doing anything about it, especially if you feel it and it's solid and it feels like a bone and it's not in the skin, you really can feel it under the skin. The only thing it really can be is the rib. And it is extremely, extremely rare to see any bone disease in that part of the
rib cage. But you had somebody come into your office today or yesterday?
2 days ago.
Two days ago. Okay.
And you raise a valid point. she is an elite athlete and presently in Texas for a soccer tournament.
Yep.
And they've been doing a lot of core training. She's been coming home at night
yep.
and really sore in the whole core area. So
it's very similar to when, you know, how bones are formed or how bumps are formed on different parts of our body. So, for example, the bump that you have on the back of your head, when you touch the back of your head, you feel a little bump. That's called the occipital protuberance. That isn't there when you're born. That only happens because as we start moving our heads and using our muscles, the muscles attach to that area and it pulls on the cartilage of that area and stretches it. And then it forms bone afterwards as you mature. Similarly, you have in front of the knee, just below the knee, at the top of the leg, there's a bump and that just under the kneecap. And that bump is called the tibial protuberance. And that that's not there when you're born, but as kids start to run around, they'll complain of leg pain because it pulls on that area, because it's stretching the cartilage in that area and forms that bump. So those are the kind of mechanisms that can lead to these kind of changes, especially in athletes that are still forming their bones.
But keep an eye on it.
Yeah, keep an eye on it. But it's certainly nothing that would strike me as being serious.
All right. We have to move along, Mike. Thank you for your call. And let's move along to Barbara now, who has a question about fungus on the toenails.
Mm-hmm.
Barbara.
Yes, hello. It's Barbara.
Hi.
I'm calling to see what advice you can give me. Is this because my immune system is compromised that I have this?
No, it's actually very common. It's something that takes advantage. It's what's called an opportunistic infection. For the same reason that we get athlete's foot, athlete's foot is a fungal infection. Feet get hot and humid, and fungus likes to grow in that environment, and you can get athlete's foot. Well, the nails are very similar, except the fungus goes in between the layers of the nail.
Yes.
And as a result of that, the nail gets thicker, it yellows, and it can actually cause a lot of problems for people because it can interfere with your ability to walk when those nails get very large.
Mm-hmm.
So there are treatments for it. The treatments are usually oral medications. Putting things on the nail doesn't help too much because anything you put on the nail doesn't penetrate through. The nail gets very thick and it's just not going to help.
At this point, two nails are off completely on both large big toes.
Well, you can always wait to see how those nails grow back. But in the treatment for it is usually a medication that you'd have to speak to your doctor about because it's expensive.
Okay.
And it's taken weekly, once a month for 1 week over 3 months. And it tends to help prevent or at least get rid of those type of infections. But you'd have to speak to your doctor about that. But it has nothing to do with hygiene. It has nothing to do with being immunocompromised. It's simply one of those things that just takes advantage of feet.
Okay. Last call for the Wednesday house call, Grace in Ottawa. Grace.
Hi, Dr.
Hi.
Duncan. Hi. Excuse my voice.
That's okay.
I'll keep it short. I finally come across what's wrong with my legs. I have the restless leg syndrome.
Right.
And, it's absolutely terrible. It comes on about 1:30 at night till about 4 in the morning.
Okay.
And I can't, the sensations are terrible. And I've lost sleep and I really don't have my energy.
You get a lot of spasm in your legs too, I'm sure.
Well, it's called creepy crawling.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so what do you do about it?
Well, there are several treatments for it. You'd have to speak to your physician about it because you have to determine other medications that you might be taking. But there is one called that I use for my patients with restless leg. There's two of them. One is called Sinemet, which is used sometimes to treat Parkinson's disease, but also can help treat restless leg. The other is called Mirapex. It's the brand name. The generic one is difficult to pronounce, so I'm just going to use the brand name. It's called Mirapex, and it's taken at night, one very small amount, usually 0.125 milligrams at night. And that can really help restless leg syndrome and calm them right down. But there are some side effects with it that you have to discuss with your physician because that can happen. But nevertheless, not being able to sleep because of restless leg syndrome can lead to a whole host of other problems. So the good news is that it can be treated, but you should speak to your physician about it. And they can certainly look up the medications that are available and try it to see if it helps you.
Okay, very quickly, I have to ask you about this. Big fad out there right now is ionized water.
Right.
All kinds of claims. Oh, weight loss, healthiest substance on earth, everything from, you lose weight to cure cancer. ionized water.
Right.
Is this, it sounds like a scam to me. What do you think?
It is a scam. They're claiming that it has alkaline properties and that it can help you lose weight.
What the heck is that? Alkaline water.
Alkaline is the reverse of acid.
Okay.
So the pH is above 7, right? 7 is is neutral. Above 7 is alkaline. Below 7 is acid. So your stomach acid has a pH of 3. Vinegar has a pH
of
5.
So it's battery water then. You're drinking battery water.
So when you think about it, if you're drinking this water, all that happens is when it goes into your stomach, the acid neutralizes it and you have regular water. So there's nothing in it that's going to make you, but you know, they have machines that are charging $2,000 for people to buy.
Yeah.
So, and there are, if you just go, just look up the science, it's basic chemistry, and you look up the science, you'll find that there's really nothing to
this. These people are making a killing.
Yeah.
They're
using fancy terms.
Ionized water. Yeah, like drink ionized water.
Take an electrode and put it into water and pass a current through it and you'll have ionized water.
I should have got into the ionized water business years ago. I knew that was going to be a gold mine. Good to see you.
Good to see you.
You're back
too.
On Sunday.
Yes, I am.
With the Sunday House Call. Sundays at 4 on CFRA.